John Towery is a professional informant who works for the U.S. Army. He works in Fort Lewis, Washington, in quote-unquote force protection. Between September 2007 and July 2009, using the alias John Jacob and the email address agent_orange@riseup.net, he illegally infiltrated various anti-war and anarchist groups around the Olympia and Tacoma, Washington area, including Port Militarization Resistance and Students for a Democratic Society. He also worked closely with the Smash ICE campaign and Iraq Veterans Against the War. Black Mass spoke to Phil Chin, an Olympia, Washington-based anarchist who's been involved in anti-war and environmental organizing in the Washington state area. Phil was among the first of the Olympia-based activists who initially discovered Towery's betrayal and dishonesty. So, welcome to the show, Phil. How did you come to find out about the true identity of John Towery?
Well, we had a we had some comrades in our community had made a couple public records requests under our Freedom of Information Act request, Freedom of Information Act. So we requested government documents related to surveillance. One set of that was a request directed at the City of Olympia for all documents on anarchy, anarchists, anarchism, and the IWW and Students for a Democratic Society. So in those documents, we found a name, John Towery, John J. Towery. And that name struck a made a connection with a person in our community who works mostly in intelligence and had suspicions about our friend John Jacobs for a while. But none of these prior suspicions could be or anything that we could confirm, you know, we couldn't, because we just didn't have any way of checking into them. And they weren't severe enough to warrant a public outing, you know?
Right.
But we got these documents and then we got the address of the John Towery person and did some surveillance on the house that for John Towery and matched his car to John Jacobs. And then we had John Jacobs come down for a meeting and took pictures of his face and then matched his motorcycle to a John Towery in Spanaway, Washington, which is where the address for the John Towery from the public records was. So we basically just got the guy's address and matched his vehicles.
Okay, so how long had John Jacobs, now John Towery, how long had he been organizing in your scene?
He was there when I moved into Olympia, which was about 2.5 years ago now. So he was around then, and I think he'd only been around a few months before me. So a little over 2.5 years.
Okay. And you mentioned that people had some suspicions about him previous. Was it, what were the issues that were coming up?
He was working on intelligence work for us for trying to predict military shipments because we knew his story has always been that he's a civilian employee at Fort Lewis, which is a major Army installation. But when he says civilian employee, he led us to believe that it was something in computers, like he was just some IT guy.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no idea that he was actually in force protection.
Okay, and he was doing this. He was providing you with quote unquote intelligence for Port Militarization Resistance.
Yeah, that was because the striker convoys that Port Militarization Resistance has sought to block are all based out of Fort Lewis. And so he was offering us information. We didn't take any classified information from him. He made a sort of offer of classified information, but we never wanted it.
Right.
But his intelligence was just really bad. He had a really bad analysis of intelligence.
Okay.
And We were a little suspicious, but we didn't think much of it. We just thought it might be because it was just kind of a dumb analysis of it, rather than anything that we thought was purposely misleading, which we now realize was purposely misleading.
Okay.
Yeah, just like questions of his work on analysis for when the strikers were moving. But other than that, that was the only real thing we had.
Black Mask did an interview with activists from Austin, Texas, shortly after Brandon Darby was revealed to be an FBI informant. And the impact of the revelations on organizers and activists in Austin seemed somewhat bittersweet, in that they were most of them were quite devastated by the breach of trust that had been caused by Darby, but they were also using the aftermath of Darby's betrayal as an opportunity to rebuild and reflect on organizing strategies and organizing infrastructure. How is Olympia dealing with the aftermath of Towery?
Well, I mean, again, another thing is that a lot of us are really shook up. Like a lot of people considered him as a friend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of us are really shook up about it. But there's definitely like work being done in light of the fact that he was an infiltrator. Especially within Port Militarization Resistance, or PMR. That process is still going on, and it's like any process, it's difficult sometimes. So, I don't know, I'm curious to see where it all goes.
Do you want to give Winnipeg listeners some idea of what Port Militarization Resistance is?
Okay, Port Militarization Resistance is an organization, depending on who you ask, it's an organization or a tactic. But there is an organization called Olympia Port Militarization Resistance, which is dedicated to keeping the military from using our port to ship out war materials to Iraq and Afghanistan. And that comes in the form of direct action to block strikers primarily, which are combat units, from leaving or getting back in.
Okay, and does it seem that the majority of Towery's informing was being done on Port Militarization Resistance, or did it extend beyond that?
I would say it extends beyond that. He was involved in a lot of specifically anarchist projects. It seems that the two main areas of focus were Port Militarization Resistance and anarchists more generally. And so he definitely was very involved in with the anarchist community around here too, which strikes a bit closer to my heart.
So how did you react then when you found out Towery's true identity?
Well, it was hard because I was working on the investigation of him. So I knew a couple of weeks before everyone else did. And so it was really hard to not go public with it, you know, because that's your first instinct. But we didn't quite have the photographic evidence that we would have needed, you know, because I understand that's very, very dangerous to accuse someone of being a cop without having any information, without having tight proof, you know? Like, you can't really leave room for error in that. So that was one really hard part was holding it in for a week or so. And then, but beyond that, like, it was hard. Like, we certainly weren't best friends, and he wasn't as close to me as he was to other people, but we were friends. We were friendly, and it hurts.
So, how is it that you think that people like Towery are able to enter our communities and gain our trust while sort of living this double life?
Well, the problem is that with Port Militarization Resistance is that it got a lot bigger in popularity, we were seeing like massive jumps in numbers as the actions went on. And so there's just no reasonable way that we could check everyone at, you know, we couldn't check into everyone when they join in the middle of an action, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking like large scale, like civil disobedience actions, rallies, you know, something that someone could reasonably show up to just on their own, you know?
Right.
And so he was getting involved with because of all that. And so, like, that's one problem is that, like, when you have mass actions and when you have lots of people joining in, then it's really easy for them to get infiltrators in.
Do you think that security culture, quote-unquote security culture practices, are helpful, or do you think they're hindering to the way that our scenes organize?
I think that there's a really general misunderstanding about security culture. And I think that, like, with PMR, like, porn militarization resistance is a completely open group. Like, anyone can join. We don't have, like, I mean, I'm sure that John's not the only infiltrator, you know? Like, I'm fairly certain that we either have had or still have other infiltrators. It seems like security culture, I don't think it would have been too relevant in the case of John, just because he got involved in the same way I got involved, you know, just showing up to meetings and showing up to actions. And so, I mean, I certainly think that, like, I mean, it's hard to, like, argue for a security culture of only work with friends you've trusted for years in things like port militarization resistance, you know?
And
so I guess I don't know if security culture would have done anything, because I don't think a security culture would have been applicable at the time.
You started out by saying that you thought that security culture was often misunderstood. What do you mean by that?
One thing that I think contributes to that is that I'm still, like, I haven't ever seen, like, a very coherent, like, conclusive definition of security culture that provides, like, a useful analysis of how to use it, you know, beyond only work with friends you've known for years. And if that's, like, the extent of security culture that we know, then what if you don't have people that you've been friends with for years, or what if your lifetime friends are apolitical, you know? The general don't brag rule is also one that I've seen come up a lot. And with things like PMR, like, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of bragging rights. I mean, like, people get arrested, like, sitting down in the street or in lock boxes, you know? We're not facing, like, federal felonies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it just seems like a lot of the security culture stuff that I've read isn't really applicable to mass action. And I don't know if it's supposed to be, and if it's not supposed to be, then it seems like a pretty solid thing if people are doing clandestine things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's wrong. I don't think it's a good idea to try and transplant the principles of clandestine action into mass action all the time. And I don't really have a problem with either, you know?
Yeah.
I think both have their uses, but I just think that they require different security protocols, and I think that the security culture that people talk about the most is applicable to clandestine actions, and a lot of it doesn't translate well to mass action.
Now, Tauri cast a fairly long shadow over a number of Olympia organizations: Students for Democratic Society, Port Militarization Resistance, the Industrial Workers of the World, all to name a few. What do you think the impact of his informing will be on those organizations?
That's a hard question to answer, you know. I think that it definitely, like, one thing that's really interesting about Tauri is that he was actually a military employee, and not a strictly civilian law enforcement agency. And so that kind of provides a new, like, a worrying thing, you know, and also the existence of these fusion centers, which are collections of law enforcement agencies that range from local to federal and military. I think that those are all, like, finding out about those is going to provide us a lot, is going to help us understand the what surveillance is going to look like, you know, because it's really a thing that I haven't seen before. I wasn't aware of the existence of fusion centers before this entire incident, or before we got these record requests. So I think that's going to make us more careful, because John was a listserv administrator for PMR. So I guess, I mean, just being more careful, and it's hard because he wasn't a provocateur, you know? A lot of times when people think infiltrator, they think provocateur, they think Anna, they think Brandon Darby, you know? They think people who try and push people into more extreme actions that wind up being traps, but that just didn't seem to be the case with John.
Right, he was just collecting information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really hard because that's almost an invisible process, you know?
Yeah. Do you think that, I guess, given the talk about the centers and you know, talking about what infiltration and informing is going to look like, do you see larger impacts than for across the U.S.?
Oh, I absolutely see larger impact. There's a document called Concept of Operations for Police Organizations, and that's written for the U.S. Army Military Police School, and that was compiled by a group of people known as Tiger Team, and John Tauri was part of that team. Like, and the paper is basically a manual for how to effectively use fusion centers, and so it looks like we were guinea pigs in this new wave of intelligence gathering.
Now, Black Mask is an anarchist talk and news show, and we tend to come at things from an anarchist analysis. But I also want to briefly talk about the legality of military spying, U.S. military spying on its own citizens. Do you know anything about that, or can you speak to that at all?
Well, there's been a few articles with a few lawyers, including one from Yale who specializes in military law, that says it appears that what they're doing is illegal. I mean, I obviously can't speak to that because I'm not a lawyer, but from what I've seen a consensus of the legal people, from like all the people. The legal people that I've seen discuss this case, I've seen almost a consensus from the ACLU, from the NLG, from these professors of military law, that what we've revealed is probably illegal.
And so, are there people in your scene who are thinking about the possibility of pursuing this by legal means?
I actually have a lawsuit in progress right now over an arrest that occurred in Aberdeen where my car was pulled over and detained because I was carrying anarchists in my car. And so my car's plates got called in with a specific number of people in that car. And so I think that's actually, and looking back at all this now, like the existence of these fusion centers, it's a lot more interesting because if the military, if I was a target of this fusion center, if I was a target of military gathering of intelligence, then I think that's a really big thing. And so I'm kind of using legal I'm kind of in the process of a lawsuit right now with that.
Do you think that Olympia could have done something differently? Like, do you think that Towery could have been identified earlier?
It's hard to say. It's really hard to say because I wasn't one of the people closest to him. But again, like I said, he wasn't a provocateur, you know, which I think makes it a lot harder in any case, because I think if infiltrators just always argued for us to use bombs, then it would be really easy to spot out who the infiltrator is, because, you know, if they were always trying to get us to do extreme actions that would be counterproductive, then it would be easy, but with John, it wasn't. He wasn't trying to get us to do anything extreme. He was never pushing a set of tactics on us. I'm pretty satisfied with the fact that we actually were able to out him, because the only other thing that I can think of was, the only other group that I can think of that's done that recently was a group in Iowa City a few months ago who managed to out an FBI agent. But most of the time when we hear that people have been revealed as informants, it's usually in the context of them getting up on the witness stand and sending a comrade to jail. And so I'm pretty glad that we were able to out John Towery successfully without anyone having to do felony time to get a felony for it, you know?
To that end, do you think there are ways that activists and organizers can be vigilant about the presence of informants, I guess informants specifically, but also provocateurs in our scenes that don't lead to paranoia amongst members of our scenes?
Ideally, I think that there are ways that we can do that. I think that, I mean, just like knowing where people live, like going over to people's houses, you know, like, I mean, knowing people's names, which may seem kind of odd, but I think that, like, just, like, knowing people's names, you know, like, I mean, if a person's using, like, a false name, and, like, I think people, I mean, and there's a phenomenon in the United States of people, like, choosing aliases a lot, but I think that if we just know each other's names, know things about each other, like, that we can verify, you know, like, knowing where people work, and, like, being able, and, like, really knowing that, or like knowing where people live and like visiting them, you know, I think that if we just like know each other better and develop tighter bonds, that we can bust a lot of the infiltrators. I think also that just because we suspect infiltrators, I think that there's a problem of like people either going too public too soon without proof, or people just like holding on and ignoring proof, you know, that people are infiltrators. I think just like kind of having like a rational, sober assessment of all that would also help a lot.
Cool. Thanks very much for being on Black Mask, Bill.
Yep. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Phil Chin, an Olympia, Washington-based anarchist who has been involved in anti-war and environmental organizing in the Washington state area. Phil is one of the activists who is responsible for the discovery of John Towery's true identity as a military informant and spy for the U.S. government. For more information on John Towery's cowardly activities as a U.S. military spy, you can check out www.johntowery.com. That's www.johntowery.com.